Welcome, everyone. Thank you for being here. It's a pleasure to be able to speak to you once again, or if you're joining us for the first time. I'm Henrik Palmgren. This is Red Ice Radio from Sweden. You can hear us three times per week. We cover a wide variety of topics that we find to be among the most interesting and important. You have a lot of fascinating programs in our archives. Please take a look. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com. Erik Falkvinge is the founder of the Swedish Pirate Party and a political evangelist for its ideas of freedom of speech and expression. The Swedish Pirate Party was the first one to be created, which has representations now in the European Parliament and has spawned pirate parties in more than 60 other countries. Falkvinge raises awareness on topics related to information policy and civil liberties in Europe and elsewhere in the world. In particular, he stresses how industrial interests of the 1900s are fighting the net's core values, the ability for everyone to publish their ideas and creations, and how these industries drive us towards a Big Brother society. Rick, an entrepreneur at heart, he founded his first company at 16 and has remained a trailblazer since. Today, we're going to talk about the Pirate Party and the Pirate Bay, and one of its founders, Gottfrid Svartholmvaj, or Anna-Kata, who is in solitary confinement in Denmark currently. We analyze this situation in more detail. We are also going to talk about surveillance, warrantless wiretapping, not only from the NSA perspective, but from a perspective in Sweden. This is an activity that has been going on in the country illegally since the 1970s, but with the pre-crime law, called the FRA law, finally being passed in 2009, it became perfectly legal to spy on everyone everywhere, effectively dragging Sweden back into the times of the Stasi in East Germany. Much more interesting stuff is coming up. Stay with us. Right. Hi, Rick. Thanks for coming on with us. I know you're a very busy guy, so we appreciate your time very much today. Thanks for coming on.
It's always a pleasure to be able to contribute to a show. So thanks for having me.
You bet. Now, tell us about the Pirate Party a little bit for people who might not have followed this story so far. Maybe you can just give us kind of a little bit of the background of what led you up to start this up, Rick.
Sure. I mean, we founded in 2006 in Sweden. I set up the prototype webpage for a new party. And what we're essentially about is the fact that civil liberties are being dismantled at an alarming rate. I mean, our children are getting significantly less civil liberties than our parents had, and that's an abysmal failure on our part on safeguarding those. So, we're being wiretapped online at a scale you could never imagine in the dystopic novels of the 1950s. So what we're about is civil liberties, and we don't think it's rocket science that our children should have the same level of civil liberties, at least as our parents did. So we were founded in 2006 in Sweden, and we've since spread to about 70 countries at last count. We're in the European Parliament. We're in a couple of national level parliaments in Europe, the Icelandic Parliament, the Czech Senate, and so on. We have some 45 seats in state level parliaments in Germany, and we've been described as the fastest growing political movement worldwide right now. And I think that's quite a journey to be part of.
Indeed. Very, very good. Now, what is the connection to the Pirate Bay, if any, then, for people, again, who are not familiar with that?
Well, we were both founded in Sweden, and Sweden was kind of really very early in broadband rollout. So the debate was kind of ahead of the bell curve in this particular country. We were founded on completely parallel tracks. The Pirate Bay were founded by activists, and we're taking the political route. You could sort of see us as Greenpeace and the Green Party, if you like. I mean, they're activists, we're politicians, but we share the same basic set of values. At times, we've helped each other out. The Pirate Bay did some advertising for the Pirate Party leading up to the election day, and we were also their ISP at one time. But still, we're separate organizations. They're activists, we're politicians.
Very good. Now, I don't know if you're a history buff, Rick, but I find it interesting that Sweden actually has a history, with the old version of piracy, as we think of it. I think it was during the Great Northern Wars that the king actually issued a letter of piracy to any ships around the world so that we could get help, because we were, at war with practically the rest of Europe at that time. So this was the only way that the king could get some kind of substantial help. And therefore, it became actually legal to plunder other ships. But what does piracy today mean in that context, Rick?
Well, the thing is, Hollywood and other industry giants, other industry monopolists, I should say, like to call those who challenge them pirates. In particular, people who share culture and knowledge online are called pirates. And we frankly don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, since this exact debate has happened once before when public libraries were rolled out around 1850s, and book publishers actually wanted a law banning people from lending books to one another. They called it stealing from the author if everybody didn't buy their own copy of the book. And I mean, we can see all of this rhetoric going full circle today. So essentially, I think this copyright industry is calling us pirates because they think that'll make us bow our heads in shame, but it failed miserably. Rather than we decided to stand tall about it and reclaim that name. And that succeeded well beyond their belief. I mean, they've even stopped using the pirate moniker. They're now calling such websites rogue sites instead because pirates have become popular.
I see. Interesting. Now, what's your view on intellectual property? We've done a couple of programs on that in the past as well. And if we buy something digitally, etc., are we the owners solely of that material? Or how do you view that, Rick?
Well, I think it's very, very important to be aware of its nature. The term you mentioned, intellectual property, is purely a PR marketing term designed to make it sound legitimate in ways that contradict its nature. If you look at the copyright monopoly legislation in the United States, for instance, it very clearly lists six specific actions that are reserved for the copyright monopoly holder of an object, regardless of whose property it is. If I buy a chair at IKEA or somewhere, I hold the receipt in my hand, then it's one of many copies made from a massive blueprint at a plant, and it's my property. I can do certain things with that property, like put it out on the porch for neighbors to use, charge them for it if I like. I can show it to friends and family. I can take it apart and use it for new projects, or I can build entirely new copies of that chair and sell them. When I buy a DVD or a Blu-ray or something like that, the same basic concepts apply, that it's one of many copies. I have the receipt in my hand. It's my property. And if this were normal property that I could do, then I could do anything with this DVD that I could also do with my chair. However, the copyright monopoly is a limitation of my property rights to this DVD. And that's very, very important to understand, that these laws are actually limitations of normal property rights. So when you're using, if you're trying to defend property rights, then you need to be strictly against these monopolies. So that same thing with patent monopolies. I mean, they're essentially banning me from putting two planks in a pattern. If somebody else put two planks in that particular pattern on the other side of the planet before me,
right,
and filed a monopoly on that, even if I've never heard of that person. So that's an obvious limitation of my normal property rights. Now, that doesn't automatically mean that these monopolies are bad. What it does mean, though, is that they have absolutely nothing to do with property rights and that they're limitations of property rights. We've seen through the ages that the copyright monopoly, for instance, is essentially serving the middlemen publishers. You can take the record industry as one example. I mean, they've been expertly ripping off musicians and those who buy their records well since the 1950s.
So do you think that this is helping to kind of level the playing field in this regard? I mean, again, some people say, well, it's stifling the funds to the record companies, to the film companies, etc., and all of this is kind of helping to slowly kind of erode that industry. How do you view that, Rick?
I think it's excellent that the internet as a concept, really, not just online sharing, but the internet as a concept, is eroding sales to these middlemen and is eroding money flow to these parasitic middlemen, because they essentially don't contribute a lot to culture. They don't contribute a lot of knowledge. What they have been doing is consistently trying to starve the supply of culture and knowledge. Now, this might sound a little idealistic, almost socialist, if you like, but we can observe that since the advent of large-scale sharing of culture and knowledge, since Napster in 1999, that's 15 years ago. So we know by now what happens when a large amount of the population starts sharing cultural knowledge in violation of this monopoly. And according to a Norwegian study, the average income of musicians has risen 114%, more than doubled. At the same time, record sales have just gone down the drain. So what we're seeing is one of the largest shifts, one of the largest wealth transfers in cultural history from parasitic middlemen to those who actually produce the culture. And I think that's a great thing.
So it's a new way of doing business, pretty much, and people are adapting to new circumstances because of the medium of the internet, and now you can become a more direct, indirect line with your customers, I guess, in this regard, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the copyright industry is not afraid of you putting their music video up on YouTube. What they're afraid of is you putting your music video up on YouTube. And that's why they're going to lawmakers crying about this horrible thing called the internet and essentially trying to turn it into cable television, where they can again starve the supply of culture knowledge.
Now, we'll see if we return to that and tie that into the discussion later. But I do want to shift over a little bit and talk about what has happened, well, in the North specifically, both with Sweden, but now in terms of Denmark with, you know, the Pirate Bay founder, co-founder, I guess, Gottfred Svartholm Varg. He's been in jail now for, I don't know how long it is actually currently, and he's been in and out of jail several times. Can you give us a little bit of the story of what has happened to him as far as you know? And I don't know if you guys know each other personally per se, but in that level, but what has happened to him and why is he being held in solitary confinement in Denmark as he currently is?
Well, to answer your question there, we've met, I mean, pretty much everybody on this, in this field of activism has met at one time or another, but well, you got to go back to the trial against the two Pirate Bay operators, its media spokesperson, and a fourth unrelated person to start seeing a pattern here. When you have a lead investigator that was openly hired by the plaintiff during the investigation itself, I mean, that's an open bribe. When you have a judge who was in the same political interest organization for harsher punishments for this kind of particular crime, who handpicked this case to himself and his own court, which is not supposed to be possible. When you have two judges in the appeals court that happen to be part of the same organization, who decided that no bias had taken place. I mean, this case has been littered with strange coincidences from the get-go, and they're all pointing at the same direction, that you have a system that is defending itself against something that threatens the status quo, and they're trying to set an example, and in doing so they don't care about anything but to try to scare others from threatening their power. So Gottfried Anakata, as he's called, went to Cambodia after the verdict. Apparently, he'd been there sometime before, so he set up an IT business there, trying to essentially move somewhere that didn't have an extradition treaty. And then came the next series of strange coincidences when Sweden posted a foreign aid package to Cambodia that was hundreds of millions above what had been the case before.
That's right.
And it just happened to coincide with a spectacular arrest of Anna Carter on Cambodian soil and an extradition that broke pretty much every rule that coincided in time exactly with this huge foreign aid package. Then you had
and sorry to interrupt, Rick, but there's no further, I guess, proof or evidence that have arisen in terms of trying to tie that money to what happened to Anna Carter in this case.
No. Of course, there's no paper trail. I mean, the people we're dealing with are smart enough to keep everything formally correct, but when you have this number of weird circumstances in a system that is desperately trying to cling onto power, you kind of have to invoke the saying that if it walks like a duck, looks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, then this probably is a duck.
Right.
And from there, Anna Carter served a jail time in Sweden. He was also indicted for a electronic trespassing into a corporation that handled part of the Swedish tax authorities' records. One of the world's best security researchers actually came to Sweden to testify for the defense on this, and he totally shredded the prosecution's defense, the prosecution's evidence. This was Jake Applebaum, who is fairly known from the Tor project,
yeah.
And he's also a world-class security researcher, saying, quote, "If my student had produced this evidence, I would have failed them," end quote. So he was actually, Anna Carter was actually acquitted of this particular crime in Sweden. He was convicted of something related to it, but he was acquitted of this particular part. And that's what he's now on trial for in Denmark.
The same thing?
Or rather, there's an ongoing investigation in Denmark for the same, as I understand it, the same instance of electronic trespassing against the same company, which just happens to be a subcontractor to the NSA. So here's, again, where you see a system defending itself. You have somebody who's associated with big power, who doesn't take lightly to being publicly embarrassed. And so they take all the European Union justice rules and just throw them out the window, specifically in this case, that if you've been acquitted of a particular crime in a European court of law, they can't just take you next state and accuse you of the same crime again. It's not supposed to be working like that.
I think his lawyer mentioned as well in Denmark currently that it's the circumstances are quite extraordinary because they've actually managed to keep him and hold him while they're doing the investigation. And this can actually prolong, I don't know how long. I don't think his lawyer even knows that either. That's a pretty rare case though of doing it this way, right? Instead of letting him, you know, be out and be free while they're doing their investigation pretty much.
This is typically Nordic, I'd say. This is the way it works in Scandinavia and Sweden and Denmark. At least Sweden has received very, very heavy criticism for this from human rights groups, calling it downright torture, that people are sometimes kept in isolation in solitary confinement for months on end while the investigation is still ongoing.
Yeah.
The official rationale for this is that they're forcefully kept from interfering with the investigation. But when it comes to that kind of human rights criticism, you can have pretty much any rationale you want. The ends do not justify the means.
Certainly. Now, so this is pretty much to, you know, they're trying to make an example out of him, obviously, for the reasons that we just mentioned, in the way that, you know, he's managed to kind of shame the different instances from the businesses involved to even those on the government level, I think. So are you think that they're going to get away with this? Are they going to be able to, you know, scare people away from continuing with this kind of work, depending on what happens to Gottfried now then, or what's going to happen, do you think?
Well, you could look at the cycles of history and see what typically happens when you have a major shift in values, a major shift in political power. The system tends to always defend itself and typically try to make a few examples out of people. But in the end, there's no holding back the tide. This was the case when the workers' movement arrived around the turn of the last century, that there was a system defending itself. They even denied printing workers' movement papers in Sweden, so they actually had to print them next state in Denmark and roll the prints across the narrow straits there to Sweden for distribution. And a number of people were put in jail for various things that in general can be summed up by challenging the system. So this is what typically happens when you have a major, major shift in power, which is exactly what's ongoing right now. That doesn't make it any easier for the people who are made examples of, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's still fairly to be expected.
So it could be he could be turned into a little bit of a martyr, perhaps at the same time. Then, so he becomes a symbol, if you will, for the movement, even stronger, perhaps after this.
I think he's already there.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at what happened after the complete injustice and miscarriage of justice that was the verdict against the two Parpe operators, its media spokesperson and a fourth unrelated person, on April 17, 2009, where they were sentenced to 1 year in jail and multi-million damages. I mean, that was essentially the Pirate Party's ticket to the European Parliament, that we had been warning people that, you know, that this is going bad. The establishment is declaring war on an entire generation here, and people have just dismissed us out of hand. Like, they didn't take the message seriously. It took this huge miscarriage of justice to wake people up and actually start kicking politicians out of office. And we're seeing that continue to happen, but it'll keep happening over the next decades as these dinosaurs are essentially kicked out of office for not understanding what society looks like these days.
Right, right. Now, before we get into a little bit more in terms of torrents and everything, I think there's a general misconception from their point of view of actually how the technology works, and that's why some of these scenarios have arisen to begin with. But nonetheless, what do you know what happened to the other guys, Fredrik Ney and Peter Sunde? Are they out of harm's way at this point, or what's going on with those guys?
Fredrik Ney, the other operator of the Parpe, is, as far as I know, safe and married with kids in Thailand. He's sort of waiting for the statute of limitations to expire, so he can go wherever he likes again. He was kind of happily cynical about that. Why would, when he could be on a boat in Thailand and living a happy life, why should he return to Sweden to go to jail? And you could see the logic in that statement.
Yeah.
Peter Sunde is still a very, very active activist. He's traveling Europe and the world to speak about these issues. And he's also running for European Parliament now as a candidate for the Pirate Party in Finland, which I think is a very interesting development should he get elected. And I think there's a more than good chance he'll do so. So that would definitely be a good... I wouldn't call it revenge. He doesn't think in those terms, but a good... coming back on his part.
Indeed. Now, let's see here if we can talk a little bit more about the torrent, kind of how, just a little bit of how that works in terms of, you know, it actually not being a server that you upload files to in that regard. It basically works as a pointer of sorts, like a road sign, I would say, pretty much. And do you think that the issues that have arisen around all this is because those people involved, I mean, I think that this became clear in one of the hearings up in Sweden when the Pirate Bay was under questioning, if you will, that they didn't really understand how the technology actually worked, and therefore all these misunderstandings kind of arose along the way. Is there more to it than that, perhaps?
No, you're nailing it perfectly. I mean, they don't have a clue. They seriously do not have one single clue. They're just seeing something that they don't like, determine that somebody needs to go to jail for this, and then they more or less invent a crime title that seems to make sense in their limited scope. And I think that's very, very dangerous. Like I said, when Jake Applebaum, the world-class security researcher, came and took a look at the evidence, he just shredded it. So partly that, and partly the fact that you have specialized courts for this that are used to dealing with copyright monopoly cases. But the problem is that the judges in these courts are very, very used to dealing with legal disputes between copyright between different parts of the copyright industry. So they're dealing with disputes between record labels, between video publishers, and so on. And the danger in that is that they have completely internalized the worldview of this industry, and they've lost touch with what has happened on the streets in the rest of the world in the meantime. So when they see a challenger that completely ignores the fact that you're supposed to have centralized distribution, who just says, what do you mean I need centralized distribution? We don't need this industry anymore. It's completely obsolete. They don't understand this message. They cannot comprehend it. They're fundamentally incapable of understanding that the entire concept of the copyright monopoly is obsolete.
And it seems to have taken them quite a long time as well to adjust to the new circumstances of what was possible with the web. I mean, obviously now there's, you know, there's Netflix, there's Spotify and other things. And I know that a lot of people have their, you know, doubts about those services as well. But nonetheless, it shows a new kind of way of distributing media coming along in this process as well. So how do you think this is going to develop in the future, Rick? What are some of the... Again, is it going to be even closer to the actual producer and the consumer, that relationship, and kind of divided out? And I guess, for the lack of a better term, is it being democratized, or what's going on here right now?
Well, the internet is kind of special in marketing terms in that there is not really a second-tier brand. There is one dominant player in each industry. So... I'm not sure the industry is democratizing. However, it's important to remember here that these services would not have been there if it weren't for the Pirate Bay and similar services. Daniel Ek, the CEO of Spotify, is very, very open and outspoken about that Spotify would not have existed had it not been for the Pirate Bay. You also need to remember that the record industry hates Pandora and Spotify, that because they would rather go back to this very, very expensive per copy sales model that they've had over the years.
Yeah,
they are essentially allowing Pandora and Spotify to exist because the alternative would be going back to the Pirate Bay. Netflix is another very interesting example in that regard. But these services also show us something else, and that's that it was never about the money. Pirates, typical people who share culture and knowledge online and manufacture their own copies from what they observe online, were never opposed to paying for good services. It was as simple a fact that manufacturing your own copy was so much easier, not just in terms of money, but also in terms of learning cost and quality, that what you could produce yourself completely and just hands down outcompeted whatever commercial offering the copyright industry had at hand. And what we're seeing now with Pandora, Netflix, and Spotify is that once you supply a good enough service, it turns out that pirates weren't opposed to paying at all. It was just that the copyright industry had such an abysmal offering that that nobody was interested in buying their stuff. They can talk all they want about how much they innovate, and they do, especially to politicians. But at the end of the day, if you're innovating shit that nobody wants, that's not going to help your business, and it doesn't score your credit in with legislators either. At least it shouldn't.
Yeah. Now, let's see here. I wanted to switch a little bit again here and go over to some of the surveillance issues that have been occurring. I mean, obviously, we know about the things that have unfolded with the NSA, and we'll see if we can get into that as well. But I wanted to look at this first from kind of a Scandinavian point of view or Swedish point of view, because we've had a lot of this, again, spearheading in Sweden, actually, in terms of the FRA, you know, law, the Swedish Defense Radio Authority, I guess we could translate that as, have actually had laws in place since 2009, I believe, January 1st, 2009, in terms of what they're, you know, allowed to surveil, what they're allowed to tap into and everything else. And it doesn't, of course, mean that they haven't done this before it actually became law. That's, you know, what we've seen with the NSA and everything else here. But how is the situation in terms of, you know, net privacy or net neutrality and surveillance in Sweden and Scandinavia, would you say, Rick?
You know, actually, let's make a segue there, which is why we're challenging the copyright monopoly in the first place, because these topics are very, very closely tied together. What we're observing is that if you have a digital communications channel today, any digital communications channel, and we might as well say communications channel because all of them are digital today, then you can also use that to share copyrighted works such as movies, music, and games without exception. Therefore, if you want to enforce the copyright monopoly today, there is no way you can do that without wiretapping every private communications channel.
Yeah.
So this is the important connection that must be understood. We are at a crossroads where we need to choose between enforcing the copyright monopoly or keeping private communications as a concept. They've become mutually exclusive. You can have one or the other, but you can't have both. And as an activist and a politician, it's my duty to take a 10,000 feet view at this and realize that an entertainment distribution monopoly for an entertainment industry is nowhere near as important to society as the ability to communicate confidentially. So this is what it's really about. And this is also why you've been seeing the copyright industry drive surveillance technologies like the Data Retention Directive, which is the huge collection of so-called metadata, where they've been driving various laws that allow breaches of privacy, because that's the only way you can safeguard that monopoly today. And so going back to where we're at with with net liberty in Scandinavia, I'd say it's as sad a state as pretty much in the rest of the Western world, that you have governmental agencies that are wiretapping practically everything. And what I think is paradoxical here is that the people who demand their privacy the strongest are people who were born so recently that they have no personal memory of the countries we'd be comparing with. They were generally born so late, they have no personal memory of the Berlin Wall, for instance.
Right.
They don't know that letters were opened wholesale in East Germany, inspected for contents, resealed and sent on their way. They don't remember the time when we were horrified at how a country could violate its own citizens to this degree. The people who do remember that aren't really upset at all that this happens online. And I think that's a complete paradox. So we're seeing a generation that's increasingly demanding to have the same set of civil liberties as their parents had when they communicated. And I think that's perfectly reasonable. If you look at the analog letter, for instance, that came with certain characteristics and certain civil liberties. I mean, when you're writing your message on a piece of paper, folding it into an envelope, sealing that envelope, and writing an address to be delivered on the outside of the envelope, you got four characteristics of that. The first is that it was anonymous. You and you alone determined if you wrote or you identified a sender on the outside of the envelope for the entire postal service to know, only on the inside in the actual letter for only the recipient to know, or frankly, not at all.
Yeah.
Anonymous letters were staple diet of tipping off the press to scandals. And we've lost that. It was untracked in transit. Nobody had the right nor the capability to see who was communicating with whom. And we've lost that. It was secret in transit. Like I said, it was only East Germany that routinely steamed open letters to see who was communicating with and writing what to whom.
Yeah.
And we've lost that. And not only have we lost the secrecy of what we're communicating, because politicians don't understand what communication is today, we are also being wiretapped in terms of what newspapers we're reading, what articles we're reading in those newspapers, for how long and in what order, what our dating habits are, vacation trips we're even planning, even if we don't actually book tickets. What's possible to wiretap today goes so far beyond what our parents could be wiretapped. And this is a very scary concept. And we've lost all of that. Last but not least, the mailman was never responsible for the contents of the message. Because, well, they were not allowed to open it in the first place. So it went without saying that they weren't responsible for it. They could not be held responsible for it. And we've lost that too. And I think this is a very, very serious development. This development is being cheered on by the copyright industry, because they can't make money in the face of sustained civil liberties. To which I say, so what? No entrepreneur gets to dismantle civil liberties even if they can't make money otherwise. Yeah. If you can't make money in the face of sustained civil liberties for our children, then you have two choices. You get to go out of business or start making something different.
Well, indeed. And I think, as well as an extension to that, and you were, you know, kind of touching on that a little bit, that this also, at the end of it, really goes outside of the copyright issues, because this has to do with study of behavior. They're building, you know, yep, profiles on people, you know, Axicom. Yep. This is the data is being sold. It's just like, it's an unbelievable opportunity, I guess, from their point of view, that they have at this particular time to really begin to study human nature. And I think, in a few instances here and there, they might, you know, hone in on a target here and there who might be, you know, that they might be interested in getting. But I think it's more generally about just kind of attaining and storing as much data as they possibly can on any human being that basically is alive and it's using the web and all the other devices and things out there, because just in case it's something that goes on in the future, whatever you do or something like that, they will have an extraordinary amount of data to tap into, to analyze, to kind of use against you, depending on if it's been, you know, what kind of behavior is being condoned or not. And so it's something far more, you know, creepy that really is going on here. And I remember, again, back to Sweden, this goes back to a particular politician, Mikael Odenberg. He started something called, you know, pre-crime with preventive bugging in Sweden.
Yep.
And,
yep,
you know, we've heard this talk before. But so all of this is coming to us within the package of, you know, we have to protect everyone against terrorism. It comes in the package of 9/11. It comes in this whole kind of geopolitical, you know, bubble, if you will. But what do you make of that? Is that really, I mean, are people really that, you know, stupid that they want to give up that level of freedom so that these people can allegedly, you know, protect us from these things, which, you know, people have asked a lot of questions about anyway? What's your opinion about this?
Well, three observations there. The first is that these packages tend to not come as packages. It's only when you take a step back and see the whole of what we've lost that you're really terrified. Each and every step can appear reasonable in its own right, in a certain light. But when you take a step back and look at everything we've lost, the picture is horrifying. So even if you just take one step, when you take 50 of those steps, each with a promise that it'll be the last, which it never is, then we're going down a path which we know where it ends. This story does not have a happy ending. There has been no happy ending of this story ever in history. So I think it's time to study a little bit of that history. The second observation is that terrorism is one such motivation for this mass surveillance. But we also know that this mass surveillance has not stopped one single act of terrorism.
Yeah.
Not one. And we know that for a very simple reason, and that is that planning acts of terror is in and of itself a very, very serious crime. But we haven't had one single such case in our public court. And since we haven't had one such single case in our public courts, then no such cases have been uncovered. It's really that simple. I mean, even the NSA, who first mumbled about, we've stopped this and this many terror plots. And then a couple of people started digging into that. And then it was, oh, we've maybe stopped one. And then it turned out they hadn't done that either. But they just wanted to continue collecting phone records because it was very interesting to them to collect phone records. And that has to be one of the lousiest motivations for a large-scale violation of civil rights I've ever heard of. So, and the third thing to keep in mind here is that at the end of the day, this is not about terrorism. It was never about terrorism. It's about pure and raw power. The United States loves buying on Europe to give its own industries an information advantage in negotiations, for example. There is industrial espionage going on with the blessing of several governments. There's a number of social dynamics that the powers that be like to keep a tab on, and so on and so forth. Terrorism was just the publicly acceptable excuse on the surface. This mass surveillance is not and was never about that. And to bring up your last point here, it's important to remember that all of this is not just being wiretapped. It's also being collected. And it's not going away. If you told somebody that anything you say or do can and will be used against you today or at any point in the future, maybe decades out, then that might get people thinking. The thing here isn't that I'm not breaking the law, so I don't have anything to fear.
Right. Yeah.
you don't know what the law looks like in 20 years.
That's right.
You don't know what values exist in 20 years. You probably did a lot of things 20 or 30 or 40 years ago that would be seen as very, very objectionable today because values change.
Yeah.
Also, these databases, like you say, they're harvesting data. They're looking for patterns. And that might sound useful, but it's also very dangerous once you start using it against people. If I'm stopping my car for 2 hours every Friday night on the main prostitution street in a major city, social services will draw certain conclusions from that specific data point. And they won't know, and they might not even care, that I'm helping my grandmother who happens to live there with her weekly groceries every Friday night.
Yeah.
It stops being about whether you're actually doing something objectionable and starts becoming about what trails you're leaving behind and how it can be interpreted by somebody who doesn't have your best interests at heart. And those are two completely different things.
Well, indeed, exactly. I mean, and in that regard, at this point, the system that's being built up is actually very stupid in that regard, because it's bad at analyzing that data. Maybe unless, then, as you said, we actually have human eyes looking at this and all that. But it's the classic. It's the tiptoe tactic towards totalitarianism, you know. But let's take a short break here, Rick, before we proceed. Obviously, we want to give out some details as well. There's much more I want to ask you about here in the second segment, regarding NSA. Other hackers that's been, kind of squeezed out of this as well, Snowden, NSA, tons of things that goes on that level. But why don't we give out some details for people who want to, read more about you, follow you on your website, if there's any other, pages you want to give out, Twitter or Facebook, or how people can get involved and support you guys and what you do.
Sure. I mean, I have a personal blog that's named falkvinge.net. That's FALKVINGE.net. And I've also published two books, one co-authored with Christian Engström about the case for copyright reform, which basically outlines the entire debate on the copyright monopoly and why it's in dire need of a major overhaul. And the second book I've written and published is called Swarmwise, and it's a leadership book outlining how you can build a major social movement on a shoestring budget. Unfortunately, my website is offline at the moment. I have a problem with my internet service provider, but by the time you hear this on air, it should be back up.
Indeed, very good. We're going to have some links up as well to Pirate Party International, I think it is. I think that's the one, right? pp-international.net, is that you guys?
Yes, it is. It is. I mean, that's the umbrella organization for the pirate parties in the various countries. Last count by a major newspaper was that we've established now in 70 countries. I mean, it varies a bit between when you draw the line at established, but we're growing very, very fast across, particularly Europe and Latin America, but also in the United States and Canada and to some extent in the Asian countries. And I think that's holds a great promise for the next generation. So that's about the pirate parties. And you can also see a lot of explanation for our policy there. Essentially, we're about net liberty and human rights for the next generation.
Right, very good. Links up on redicecreations.com. Stay with us, Rick. We'll be right back after this break. We'll be right back. We continue with Rick Falkvinge in our second hour on our members' website. We talk more about paranoid and suspicious authorities. He urged people to adopt what he calls information hygiene, basically keeping clean all the things that you don't want to have lying around about you online. We talk about data mining, how governments build profiles now on people on a scale that never before has been seen in history, and the dangerous aspects that comes along with this. We talk about WikiLeaks, Assange, the Nordic model, and we get deeper into the environment within Swedish society and critique its conformity and soft totalitarian sentiments, largely unknown to the rest of the world. We move on to discuss net neutrality, the censorship on the web, Snowden, and the turf war between the NSA and the CIA regarding who will get to spy on the world. Sign up for a subscription if you haven't already and get full access to all our programs. It's just about the price of 2 cups of coffee per month, and you'll not only get access to all our fascinating radio programs with invaluable perspectives and education and videos, films, commentaries, and everything else, you'll also help to keep us free from commercial interruptions and free from ads on the websites. Keep us expanding and help us to grow. RedIceMembers.com. Go there, sign up. If you're not a member, this is the program you'll want to catch the second hour of. Before we continue, upcoming we have Radio 314 with Aaron Dykes and Melissa Melton from Truth Stream Media. Then on Red Ice Radio, Dan Fogler, Richard Dewhurst, Ben Davidson, Robert Felix, Sophia Smallstorm, William Lynn, and John King. A lot of good shows coming up. Right now then, we'll continue with Rick Falkvinge. Stay with us, everyone. RedIceMembers.com. We'll see you there. Thank you so much for listening.